Hello everyone, I'm Lucy Rigby and welcome to Housefeld's seventh collective cast, our podcast about all things collective redress. We're joined this week by a special guest, Liz Cole, who is the proposed class representative in a collective action against Google. And we're also joined by the partner leading on that matter, Leslie Hannah, and Keo William from Housefeld as well. So it's fantastic to have everyone with us, and we're going to be discussing in some detail Liz's claim against Google. So first of all, Liz, over to you. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yep. Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Yep. So I've just started working on this case, which was filed in July. I work as a consumer tech policy consultant, and prior to that I've worked a lot in consumer organisations, so really pleased to be involved in this.
Fantastic. Okay, well yeah, great to have you with us, Liz. And so let's go right back to the beginning, start with the basics on this claim, Leslie. What's this claim about?
Hi, Lucy. So Liz's claim is a collective claim, and it's a claim for compensation for the harm caused by Google's abuse of its dominant position in the market for app distribution on Google Android devices. So it's a claim, abuse of dominance claim, both for EU and UK competition law. And Liz's claim essentially concerns Google's app distribution platform, which is called the Play Store, where Google has used a number of as unlawful tactics to close down competition on that market, meaning that there is a lack of effective competition in app distribution on Android devices. As a result, where Android users are buying apps or making what are called in-app purchases, so that's buying something in a game, buying tokens, buying a subscription in the Play Store, they have to use Google's proprietary payment system. And as a result, they are charged excessive and unfair fees. So that's the 30% commission that's charged both in respect of purchases of apps, but also for in-app purchases.
Okay, I see. And when you say the class, and we're talking about the anti-competitive effect, how widespread is the consumer detriment stemming from Google's conduct?
Well, really, it affects everybody who has made purchases in the Play Store. So anyone who has bought an app or made a purchase within an app or has a subscription in an app that is on the Android system through the Play Store. That means that we estimate there's around 19.5 million UK consumers who will have been affected. And we anticipate that losses could be in the region of around £920 million, which includes simple interest. We think that with 19.5 million users, we think that loss could be around sort of £45-50 per proposed class member on average.
Okay, so significant, basically. Okay, and so, and Liz, I want to understand a bit about what led you to this case. But before we get to that, what are your views on private enforcement in the courts more generally? Because there have been a few of these claims now, as you know, and private enforcement, it feels, is playing a bigger role. Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, I think it's a really helpful lever for consumers, and particularly in digital markets, because private collective redress and collective redress works best when there's this kind of maybe a smallish amount of harm that's spread across an awful lot of people. So widespread individual harm, and it's not necessarily always that small, but it's a kind of experience on an individual level. But that adds up to quite, when you look at it and put it all together, that can add up to like millions. so it's definitely felt by consumers. And also it means that, I mean, the market's not working brilliantly if you have those kind of overcharges and things happening. So I think it's really strong as a way of signalling to companies that, you know, those kind of practices aren't okay and they will be held to account. And I think it's also, what I also really like about it is it's very tangible for consumers. So, you know, you can enter a process to get your money back in your pocket. So I think that makes it quite an interesting mechanism as opposed to other ways of enforcing consumer rights. So, you know, some policy legislation or something which you might not feel. So I think it's quite a nice, it's quite empowering in a way to be able to get something put right that's gone wrong. And as I say, I think for digital, it's really interesting because it really lends itself to these kind of small infractions and individualized harms that are happening to people, which again add up to something much more widespread. And there's lots of different cases in all sorts of different aspects of digital. So I think against Apple for its in battery gate, where it was deliberately being slowed, there's claims in Italy and Belgium. I think there's a case being brought in Holland against TikTok for the use of children's data. So it's, I think people are really waking up to this as to collective redress for digital in a really interesting way, and hopefully keeping up pressure and scrutiny on companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and is it those specific things which has led you to this case? Because I'm conscious that you have a wealth of experience actually in this area.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've always worked in digital consumer protection in particular. So I worked at Consumer Focus and Consumer Futures, which are like the UK statutory bodies, and at Citizens Advice. So looking at how consumers experience digital and what that feels like in their everyday lives, what goes wrong, and also what can be quite positive and what could work better. And then I went on to work at Consumers International, which is an umbrella body for all consumer groups from around the world. So that would be Which in the UK, and then Consumer Reports in the US, and then right down to some really tiny grassroots, almost voluntary ones all across the world. I suppose my reflection would be there's so many different ways that you can get consumer interests heard, and I've done a lot of those in those other roles. So, you know, research or drafting recommendations, running campaigns for consumers for how they can like protect themselves online. And certainly at Consumers International, working with organisations all across the world to sort of share how you might build capacity on what issues are affecting consumers and what might be good policy asks. So there was all those different approaches you can take. But I think enforcement was not something that I'd had experience of. So it was a really, for me, it really appealed to sort of get in there and be doing some of the practical enforcement and really looking at how those rules and processes which are there to protect consumers actually work. So that's why I was really interested in it. And I think the other thing that really appeals was this kind of the coming together of anti-competitive effects and consumer protection. It's just the awareness of that is much, much higher. And we've done a lot of research, and I'd led research into data and AI and things like that, and was really hearing that consumers very, very strongly feel, first of all, that they really enjoy digital and all it's given them, but they feel slightly backed into a corner. So they feel their choices are limited. It's kind of all or nothing, like you accept what the offer is from the company because it's so convenient and it's so essential to your daily life, then it's very difficult to negotiate or to turn it down. So, and I think they picked up this sense that consumers really felt, well, what would I do if something went wrong? Or would I even know if something had gone wrong or if a company had been acting unfairly? And I think this case was really, to me, about very much about that. That's the heart of it. So people are bearing costs, probably not even aware of it, and there's very little they can do about it, because if you own an Android phone, very limited options for another app store. Similarly with Apple, if you're in an Apple phone. So I think pulling that out was also a really important part of the case.
Yeah, I can certainly see that there's a lack of transparency, I think, isn't there, and consumer awareness of certain aspects. Now, you mentioned Apple. there's an overlap between, I think, the conduct that Leslie described and that the matter that you're bringing against Google, and the same allegations against Apple. Now, I know that we've had some recent judgments in the US in App Store related cases. You presumably have been following those. Have you had what's your reaction been to what's going on in the States?
It's been really interesting, and I think I've followed the Epic case from when it first started. And it was obviously more focused on developers and not so much on the consumer cost there. So I thought it was great it finally got there, and there was lots of interest on it. And what was interesting to me was the definitions of being anti-competitive and in what market. So I've learned very quickly through this process how important those market definitions are. So the judge saying it was not Apple's behavior was not anti-competitive in terms of the whole App Store distribution, but it was in terms of the mobile game distribution. And the mobile games, it's huge. It's a really billion dollar industry and played by huge amounts of people, and one of the biggest app downloads are games. So that was interesting, and I think that other regulators and judgments would probably not agree with that market definition because they use different ways to define it. But what came through really clearly was that, regardless of the market definition, was that 30% was completely unjustified. And that's obviously helpful for our case, but also helpful in terms of upping scrutiny generally on charges that digital companies make. So something like apps, which is relatively new product, what is a fair or justified price? 30% feels pretty arbitrary. And I think what the case in the US and other cases are doing is really lifting the lid on what it actually costs to run these services, and show it, and actually making that public to consumers, and then exploring whether that's justified or not. So for me, the 30% finding was really interesting and welcome.
Yeah, okay. And I certainly take the point on the increasing scrutiny that, all these claims around the world are bringing.
And it's interesting because I think for a long time, lots of debates in privacy and consumer circles were around, paying for stuff with data and the fairness and the ins and outs and the rights of that. But we sort of forget that as well as services we pay for the data, a lot of us are paying money for things as well. And that seemed to have got a lot less scrutiny over the years. So I think these kinds of cases are really helpful for saying, it's not just the data exchange that's unfair potentially, but it's also the ones that you're paying for with your money.
Yeah. And I hesitate to get into the data related issues that you raised, because I suspect we could probably spend a couple of hours discussing all that too. One of the points that I wanted to move to is the relationship between this case and the Google Android decision from the European Commission, which I understand Keo is being appealed. I think I'm right in saying that you spent some time in Luxembourg. What were your views on what happened last week?
Yeah, thanks, Lucy. So I spent 5 days last week attending the hearing, and it was very interesting. Liz's claim, whilst being standalone, it mimics a number of findings that were set out in the Commission's decision, such as the Commission's analysis of the relevant markets and how Google's agreements with device manufacturers unlawfully shut down competition in those markets. So whilst the decision doesn't necessarily touch on the 30% commission itself, which is the focus of Liz's claim, it makes infringement findings in respect of lots of the anti-competitive conduct that actually enabled Google to charge that fee in a vacuum. So as you say, the decision itself is subject to appeal, and of course it's impossible to know what the judges in the general court felt after hearing a week of pleadings last week. But on balance, my sense was that the general court seemed receptive to the Commission's defence of its decision, particularly on the points that we're most concerned with, which are those on market definition, dominance, and most of the unlawful agreements that were put in place during the relevant period that Google used to shut down competition. The court did spend some time probing some aspects of the decision, which perhaps Google felt that they had the better of the arguments, and that might be relating to revenue sharing agreements during the early stages of infringement, which those agreements are essentially exclusivity agreements with device manufacturers to ensure that Google's services are exclusively installed or placed in premium placements on devices. And a lot of the discussion around those were whether the coverage of those agreements was sufficient to foreclose competition in the market, and whether the procedural point that the Commission picked the right test and then applied the test correctly for then finding making a finding of infringement. So on balance, it went very well as far as Liz's claim is concerned, but what the court does next is anyone's guess. It could uphold the decision in full. It could annul aspects that, based on substantive or procedural grounds, it doesn't agree with. But we hope to receive the judgment within 12 months with a good tailwind. That's what we can hope for. And we'll have to watch this space and see what happens next.
Okay, that's really interesting, Keo, thanks. And so it's 12 months on a good day.
The Google shopping decision has taken slightly longer than that, but obviously we've had unusual circumstances over the last 18 months or so, but hopefully it should be a bit quicker than that judgment.
Okay, fingers crossed. And Leslie, just by way of final question, what are the next steps in relation to Liz's claim?
Well, we've just had permission from the CAT to serve on three of the five defendants, so the other two have already accepted service, and so that will be the next step. Then there'll be a case management conference listed where we'll set out the timetable for the claim, and then a CPO hearing, which will be where the CAT decides whether the claim is certified to proceed as an opt-out collective action. And so we're hopeful that we'll be able to get that scheduled soon and get a decision on certification.
Great. And I think, I mean, one of the things that we've certainly seen, I think, particularly on the BT collective action, which was the subject of our last collective cast, that the CAT is really speeding up now. That claim was filed in January, I think, of this year, and there's already been a CPO granted. So I think we're seeing a speeding up of the timetable on these, which is great, post the Merricks related delay having come to an end. So hopefully this claim will also move quickly through the various stages as well. And yeah, hopefully we can talk to you again, Liz, as and when the claim is certified, and then as a successful settlement or judgment, as the case may be. But thank you very much indeed for talking to us today. That was really interesting.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Right, pleasure. Thanks very much all.
Thank you.
Thanks.